Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jeff Bachman, making my debut on this channel, so thank you all for listening. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Benjamin Ricci's about his new book, The Politics of Annihilation, A Genealogy of Genocide. This is really a remarkable book that I look forward to discussing with our guest on today's show. Ben Ricci's, welcome to the show. Ben, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm currently assistant professor of security studies and conflict resolution at the University of Washington at Tacoma. I'm originally from the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, Minnesota. I completed my undergraduate work at Whitman College and my doctorate at Johns Hopkins University.
Great. And how did you become interested in studying genocide?
You know, when I entered grad school, I thought that I was going to write a project that was about the post-war foundations of international humanitarian law. And when I started that project, I actually got curious because I was reading the documentation of Raphael Lemkin, an access rule in occupied Europe. And it struck me as a real curiosity that even though genocide seemed like it was a significant political concept, one that was widely identified by humanitarian and other audiences, that it was so startlingly new. Like it was only 75 years old or 70 years old at that point in time. And that kind of puzzled me. And I think that I took a detour early on in the project to try to learn more about the evolution of that particular term. And it kind of grew into a much broader project. But the underlying interest in trying to think about what forms of mass violence are understood and recognized and combated by the international community was probably there from the beginning. It was sort of my aspiration to focus on that project. I think that a lot can be said about society and its ethics on the basis of the way that it takes care of people's suffering. And this seems like sort of the most gratuitous example of that, if that makes sense.
Sure, definitely. We'll come back to that because I want to get a question to you about your interest maybe in armed conflict and genocide and where those interests might overlap. But before we get to that, did you have a mentor as you were transitioning to the study of genocide?
I worked with one person in particular who was kind of an expert on post-colonial readings of international law, which was Siba Grovagi, who was at that time at Johns Hopkins University. He's now in the Africana Studies Center and Department of Political Science at Cornell University. I also worked with Dr. Bill Connolly and Dr. Jennifer Culbert, who works on the death penalty domestically, but we're both political theorists who are concerned about violence and fascism.
And so transitioning to the book, how did you come to write this book? And also, how did you come to write this book the way that you wrote it?
Well, I can start with the first one of those questions, and maybe I'll ask you for a little clarification about the second. So this book was the dissertation project. And as I said just a minute ago, I was interested in the kind of newness of the concept of genocide, why these particular terms and figures and ways of thinking about mass violence had become prominent and about that history. And like a lot of people, I'm sure I'd been kind of introduced before to humanitarian intervention in the context of globalization and human rights discussions, Samantha Power, those kinds of works before. But it was in the process of digging through some of the travaux préparatoire for the Genocide Convention, reading Lemkin's own text, you know, first kind of the stuff that Donnelly Freeze and people like Stephen Jacobs have done to unearth and popularize that, and then later further work that. I thought it was just incredibly curious. You know, to draw a kind of point of contrast, for instance, I really like Douglas Irvin Erickson's book, the 2017 work on Raphael Lemkin, but I was also somebody who was also training in political theory at the same time, and I decided I wasn't going to write a book that was exactly a kind of history of Lemkin as an intellectual or the concept in a kind of chronological fashion, but more trying to understand what the different theoretical parts of the concept were doing, why people had latched onto them over time, and how the concept was different or the discourse was different in its sort of first iterations from where it had ultimately developed. So that was a multi-year process of kind of reading and learning and figuring things out and trying different avenues. I've been in my kind of theoretical work really influenced probably by two or three thinkers. Michel Foucault, who's obviously written a tremendous amount on genealogy and archaeology and the importance of discourse, but also Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari's work on assemblage theory, which is a different approach to understanding the sort of construction of the social world, one that affords material objects and processes a lot more potency than traditional social theory has. And then lastly, Kathleen Malabou's work on plasticity, which is a way of understanding the power of form rather than substance. And it really helped me kind of interpret genocide along a slightly different lens than I think other people have up to this point. But I was going to ask you then, when you said, how did I write the kind of project out, what did you mean by that? Sure. So Foucault picks up on this term.
It kind of connects to the last bit that you were talking about there. So I was interested in the method of your research. And so you mentioned genealogy, assemblage, and plasticity. Can you explain to our audience what those means in terms of your research?
And he has a bunch of sort of methodological notes. It's a term that he actually steals from Friedrich Nietzsche. And to just be as brief as possible about it, it's a way of thinking through history that allows for discontinuities and interruptions in a way that classical histories often don't. And in particular, it doesn't allow or start with a single point of origin, but rather a series of competing forces. It kind of showcases the contingency of any series of developments over time. And as a consequence, it uses a little bit of a different way of thinking about chronology. Foucault uses the term episteme, for instance, to refer to a block where a certain set of terms or understandings become sensible. And one of the things that I tried to develop in this book is that even though there's only been, say, 75 years of people really using the term genocide, that there are quite different epistemes already built into the concept. I think there's one sort of that's budding and being debated and competed around in the formation of the Genocide Convention. There's probably another turn some point in the 70s and the 80s, and still even potentially a newer concept now in the past couple of decades, although it's not quite that clearly spelled out in terms of the timeline. So Foucault helped me try to think about what was going on in terms of the movement of ideas in a way that was a little bit different than the classical reading of the concept or the debate, like the contestable concepts debate that we have in genocide studies, where terms are kind of taken in a static way where we don't think that they've historically shifted. And one of the kind of key insights is that even though people might be using the same language, they might actually be speaking almost entirely different languages. And I think that was a real key in terms of kind of unpacking elements of what was at stake in genocide. Assemblage theory is, a growing part of a focus on materialism and materiality against the kind of social constructionist turn that's been powerful in the social sciences for the past couple of decades. Deleuze and Guattari, in a book called A Thousand Plateaus, outline that all ontology is based off a series of machines that combine and interact with one another in different ways. And often they can refer to things that are as simple as a house, which requires materials and people and bacteria and all other kinds and wind flows and air pressures in order to be able to make it work. But they also pay attention, interestingly enough, to language. So they focus on what are called incorporeal transformations. And what they mean by that is the way in which specific uses of language have material effects that we can register. Sometimes these are also called Cambridge changes. So the example that's very classical is that the material body, if we were to study it, of a person accused of a crime is no difference between them being declared innocent or guilty by a judge And yet the pronouncement, the statement of one of those two words has a profound impact on the course of that person's life. And so they're trying to figure out, how does all of the different factors that would lead to the power of that one person's declaration actually work? Because a sort of, you know, an alien coming from nowhere and looking at that situation might go, this is really weird. We have, you know, two large mammals that are simply interacting. And because one says one thing, all of a sudden we have these cascading series of effects. So assemblage theory provided me with a different lens to try to read through what kind of the elements were of the concept of genocide in a way I don't think that other people have taken as seriously. So in the book, I try to unpack kind of four different components of the concept, those being group and identity, destruction and violence, what I call the parts whole distinction or a mirological distinction, and then intent and desire, which is something that I think you see iterated out in many different discussions around genocide, but not made explicit. And the other piece that assemblage theory helped me to kind of work through is the way in which then the concept actually becomes a materially powerful element of particular social context. So in an area like genocide prevention, for instance, the appearance of genocide, unlike other terms, sort of supercharges the desire that people have to be able to respond to one particular epoch or instance of suffering. And so we had to kind of note and think through that effect. The last character there, Malibu, is sort of a newer, or for me, a newer resource to think through. But I think that her model of plasticity is to reinterpret form as, and like here we're talking form versus content, as a sort of potent ontological artifact. She thinks that in anything that is plastic has the capacity to both be formed in the hard sense. So we're accustomed to thinking about plastic in that way, like plastic water bottles. But something that's plastic is also formative and transforming over time. And what the real kind of connection here for me was is that at stake in the concept of genocide is an interest in the form that violence takes. And here we can think about like form in terms of what groups are subjected to violence. So if we just take a random aggregate of people and we committed one act of violence against them, that would be probably a crime against humanity. But if they had a particular type of identity, that imposition of form is sufficient to make it potentially a charge of genocide. I mean, there'd be a lot of other circumstances there. And so I started thinking about, okay, why are we interested in form in this way? And what are the stakes of kind of building an entire model on specific kinds of forms? And her work just kind of unpacked some of that for me. Hope that answers the question.
It does. It does. Thanks, Ben. Something you said about the common language, I wanted to come back to that because I think it does connect to what you talk about as the hegemonic understanding of genocide. It's interesting in, I think, human rights literature and genocide studies, or maybe at the activist side, they talk about how the development of human rights law and concept of genocide and the Genocide Convention gives people a common language with which to talk about human suffering, their own plights, what people are dealing with. But common language does not necessarily mean same meaning, right? So you use the same words, but if they mean different things to different people, then you could have some conflict or headbutting there. So I was thinking about this in terms of the hegemonic understanding that even if there are different meanings, some meanings may be more accepted or become sort of the norm within the international community or activists or whatever the case might be. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this idea of the hegemonic understanding of genocide.
Yeah. So in the book, I came up with this term to try to crystallize one of the major changes, I think, in genocide discourse in the past, say, four decades, but also to describe it as an obstacle on the one hand and as something that enables politics on the other. And I'll try to clarify. So in the book, I call it a form of discursive practice. And by this, I mean, it's not just one definition of genocide, right? Say the UN Genocide Convention's definition that is the hegemonic understanding of genocide. It's rather the set of assumptions or implicit presuppositions that people use when they talk about genocide, so that it's a self-evident concept, that it's supposed to kind of have immediate political implications, and that most of its components, whenever we're talking about it, fall into pretty dominant representations or social imaginaries, right? So we're not going to have to dig into the complexities, for instance, of whether or not the Basarwa in Botswana are in fact a group that should appear and could be subject to genocide. They just kind of always already are. And what I wanted to tease out there is that I think when we're talking about the common language that people discuss, you know, in human rights literature and literature on mass atrocity and genocide, a lot of that is assuming the hegemonic understanding of genocide in the background. So, for instance, if you read, I think, somebody like, and I mentioned Samantha Power earlier, a lot of the work that is done to sort of popularize this and say, okay, we all need to get behind the agenda of ending mass violence is a particular set of assumptions about what that violence looks like and which episodes we should care about. And actually, like your work, you have this beautiful piece of writing on the statistics of genocide publication that I hope gets published someday soon, kind of showed out some of this, right? So very few people would contest, for instance, that the Nazi genocide, the Rwandan genocide, or the Armenian genocide are cases of genocide, although obviously we could get into Turkey as another set of questions there. But those more marginal and peripheral cases are where a lot more conflict comes in terms of the competing interpretations that you're describing. And what I see as hegemonic is the gesture of saying, no, only some of these really count because of, and then insert your background assumptions here. And you can actually detect this in a lot of different places and ways in genocide studies and the way that activists use it. I'll just use a couple of examples that are both present in the book. So for instance, William Chaos has got this great work, Genocide in International Law, which is probably the best volume and kind of explaining all of the different court cases that have surrounded genocide interpretation and how the Tremblay Repertoire has been used. And it's a fabulous work. But there's one point in it where he comes along to try to explain why the Genocide Convention's definition makes sense. And he actually says, well, we have to use these background assumptions to interpret the language, and then it kind of works out correctly. And that we have to assume these background assumptions is the part that I want to foreground, not because it's intrinsically problematic. Those assumptions may be good. They may enable specific kinds of productive political action, but they may also have exclusions, limitations kind of built into them. And that's what needs to kind of be brought up. Another example that I'll pull out, and it's from a totally different context, but it's another instance where kind of the hegemony is present, is this really interesting case from the mid-90s with Schindler's List and Steven Spielberg at this Oakland high school. And I can't remember the name of the high school off the top of my head. It was a crisis in California for a little while because a class of junior high school students in Oakland were taken to go and see Schindler's List in this way that was, you know, using Schindler's List as a means to teach about genocide and Holocaust. And one of the kids snickered in the middle of the film, and it became kind of a local media event. You know, how do these kids are so out of touch? And they actually brought in Spielberg and the governor of California at the time to lecture the students in this high school about their lack of sensitivity and their failure of suffering. And it turns out that the students that they're lecturing are coming from largely indigenous communities. They're coming from Black communities. So there's immediate kind of visceral experiences of racism and also a background potentially of genocide and mass violence there as well. And yet there was this assumption that somehow Spielberg's work was intrinsically going to have a better sense of what genocide was actually about because it fit our stereotypes. And so there was like this castigating of 14-year-olds when, you know, we don't really know the circumstances behind why a 14-year-old was laughing in the theater, right? They could have been telling a joke to their friend. Whether or not that's appropriate or not seems really disproportionate to the reaction. And so I think you can see kind of the hegemony of one understanding being used against another experience pretty directly there in a way that should strike us as odd, because most of the time 14-year-olds' laughter doesn't actually constitute a major media event.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. It's easy to assume that the laughter was at the film, or if you're sitting on the subway and a kid laughs, you might think you're laughing at you for some reason when it could be something completely
or just telling a joke to their friend or whatever it is at that point in time. Right.
So the hegemonic understanding, how did it become hegemonic? And maybe a related question would be, you know, there's different fields, right? There's this field of politics and there's the influence that politics have over the understanding of genocide. And then there's the legal part, but then there's also the scholarship part, right? So do these three things interact in some ways? And one of the, I guess a reason I asked this question, or at least one reason, is it always sort of perplexes me that the hegemonic understanding is reproduced in scholarship or some scholarship over and over again. And I just wonder why scholars are not, you know, more willing to move outside of that hegemonic understanding in their research. So I don't know if that's a loaded question, but.
So I think that there are a number of really key moments in each one of those communities that need to be kind of starred, and their relationship with one another is important, but there's also some divergences there. And those are important to note as well. So obviously we've got this kind of somewhat clear story about the Genocide Convention, the obstacles that it faced, the difficulty of the various kind of great powers and taking it seriously, and all of the editing down from Raphael Lemkin's sort of initial formulations of genocide, which were much more expansive along multiple lines. And that's a really important moment that a lot of people have called attention to. And I think that we're learning more and more about the different reasons why that became complicated from, you know, Alexis Stiller and Anton Van Vyse and other people that are historians of that period that do really fine work. I think that actually, though, the hegemonic understanding of genocide is consolidated in my mind at a much later point in time. And it's partly a consequence of the work that happened in that period, but partly not. So I actually think that it's a series of scholars that start writing in the 1970s that is a pretty important moment for the academic community, kind of that first generation of genocide scholars, where genocide becomes important for castigating a number, or describing or analyzing as well, a number of different acts of essentially heavy-handed state violence, right? So we've got communism and the massacres under Stalin and massacres under, you know, the Cultural Revolution that are criticized on the one hand. We've got kind of the formation of a left critique of the Vietnam era violence, right? There's like the Russell tribunals of the United States that embraced the language of genocide in really particular ways. And it starts to trickle in at that stage. And I think that there's a little bit of an uncritical reading of what genocide is at that moment. And one that certainly has an amnesia with respect to how much dispute there was in the 1940s around the setting of the terms of that. And I think that part of the hegemony, or the desire for there to be a hegemonic understanding, comes from the fact that scholars in that period really wanted to change the way that they saw mass violence occurring and they saw warfare occurring. And so they're, you know, very, very much willing to seize on to the moral dimension and the moral urgency surrounding that term and try to build it up into one thing. And I think that instinct actually is a really important one, because it's part of what helps to politicize things. But it also then leads to a problem where all of these other issues come up in the way that you define and you think about something that you know, you've excluded other experiences and led to marginalization and invisibilization and other effects like that. So that's one moment. And I think that genocide studies has, over the past, say, 40 years, you know, both worked itself into being a field as insofar as it exists, and it has tried to play with those limits and to contest them in different ways. And there's lots of important work. The contestable concepts paradigm, or the discussion of that in the past two decades, is probably the richest point of clash. There's a lot more that's subterranean, but you can see elements of that going back to Tony Barta and before that, that are saying we need different conceptions of how this process plays out. That's one kind of strand. And I think that part of the reason that the desire for it to be hegemonic is still there is because that community very much wants to influence the way that genocide intervention and genocide prevention efforts occur. And there's this assumption that if it stands out morally in this way, and if it's self-evident in this way, that for some reason will induce political changes. And what's odd to me a little bit as somebody who studies international relations is that the obstacles geopolitically to intervention are in a certain way much more complex than the study of why mass violence itself occurs in some sense. And so I think that there's some lack of attentiveness to the actual function of using the language. And so maybe that's one of the things we could tease out or discuss further about the hegemonic understanding. With respect to politics and law, Again, I think you have a resurgence of interest in the concept in the 80s and the 90s. And obviously, those are in reference to events in former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda. And there, I think you can see that there's some dissonance between what the Genocide Convention and the Travail Preparatoire say about genocide and the way that the courts then pick it up and the international dialogue and legal dialogue start. And I think some of that, again, is strategic in efforts to try to confront new problems as they've emerged. And part of that also is reading a term, kind of inheriting a very, at that point, you know, small-scale dialogue about what the substance of genocide is, and then importing some of those assumptions as well, and having a little bit of a back and forth with scholars. Politically, it seems like the term has picked up really substantially only in the past, I would say, two or three decades. And here's what's kind of interesting to me. I think it coincides with the human rights moment. And I've relied a little bit in the book on Sam Moyne's work on the development of human rights. And Moyne makes an interesting case that human rights as a kind of term, that what he calls the last utopia, is really a 1970s, 1980s development. And the point he makes is that kind of the grand democratic capitalist vision and the grand communist vision had both sort of failed to provide the sorts of improvement globally that everyone had interpreted. And human rights becomes a discourse of last resort, where it's the most minimal set of expectations that we should get in terms of freedom and non-harassment from the state. And so everyone can kind of seize onto that in the decline of these two competing visions. And I actually think that it's at that stage that politically there's this need to sort of reinvent genocide as the most extreme of any kind of human rights violations. And so it sort of gets rebranded, whereas we know there was conflict with Lemkin in the 40s and the human rights movement, and those were not totally coherent agendas. They're almost, if you will, separate ways of thinking about it, advancing a kind of international justice model. And so I think it's at that stage also that anchor comes together, and genocide really becomes like the pinnacle event that we all need to pay attention to, and that the hegemony gets underscored. And so you have kind of three different political strands all coalescing together and all emphasizing the importance of this concept without really ever thinking about some of the underside of its hegemony.
Right. And there's a lot of contributions to the literature that talk about the importance of differentiating genocide from war crimes, wars of aggression, other crimes against humanity, most of it based on the specific intent aspect so genocide has been called the crime of crimes, but during the Nuremberg tribunals, they also were talking about the aggressive war as the enabler of other crimes such as genocide. So it's interesting to see this move to make genocide sort of at the top of this hierarchy of international crimes. The hegemonic understanding, going back to what you were talking about intervention, how has the hegemonic understanding influenced the evolution and development of institutions and norms around the prevention of the crime?
I think that the most obvious place actually that it does is in the kind of explosion or proliferation of both international government and NGO efforts at genocide prevention. There's both productive and problematic aspects to that. So, if we take something like Genocide Watch, for instance, Greg Stand has a lot of great essays. He spotlighted a tremendous number of important insights into mass violence. There's the 8 and the 10 stages scales that are really excellent tools for pedagogy. But something that then happens in mapping the world in this way is that some of the assumptions about what types of identity, what forms of violence constitute genocide get built into the pedagogy and into the advocacy, and then they kind of disappear or they filter into the background. And you can really see that the hegemony of the concept is necessary to launch that kind of platform. And again, that's for better and for worse. There are great efforts to expand and focus on mass violence in ways that didn't exist 2 decades ago or didn't certainly exist 4 decades ago. And at the same time, there are problems that accrue with that in terms of who gets represented, how those representations are utilized, what forms of international power are legitimized or not. And so I think that that's just a single case where you can really see that hegemony coming to bear. The book uses a number of different case studies depending on they're very brief, depending on the top part of the concept that we're talking about to sort of tease that out. So it begins with an example, for instance, where there was a dispute about the status of the Bisarwa or the San in Botswana, which are a nomadic group that got removed from the Central Kalahari Game Reserve. And there's a question of whether or not there was a kind of genocide there, or if in fact it was sort of too small, or the group didn't quite fit, or if the state really intended, all the traditional doubts. And a lot of the people who are concerned with the Basarwa are imploring and using a kind of hegemonic understanding of genocide to say, well, actually, this is not that. It's just it's a more minor human rights thing, even though, look at the scales of the violence, it's still pretty significant. Sections of the work discuss some of the complexity of thinking about the Rwandan genocide in terms of group identity, which is a more well-known and well-established point, but it illustrated that, sometimes the conception that seems to be hegemonic is one of sort of a strong ethnic or racial conflict that maybe didn't map as well into those circumstances. And so it to some degree undermined our ability to think about what genocide prevention might look or genocide intervention might look like in the aftermath of the conflict there. Other cases include the allegation by a group called Fidissima, which is a Brazilian NGO against the United Nations for their spreading cholera in Haiti in 2010. There they actually explicitly said that it was what they called an unintentional genocide, which of course is a nonsensical term from the vantage point of international law. So I tried to unpack what were they doing with the notion of a genocide without intent explicitly. And then there's a few other cases from the use of narcotics in the context of China and some of the discussions that went in the Genocide Convention there and about mass violence a myriad of other examples.
When you mentioned that it's nonsensical, the unintentional, do you see a difference between purposeful negligence, foreseeable knowledge, but unintentional? Are these things really distinct, or do they overlap in some ways, do you think?
I think that so this is what the book tries to show, is that there are different understandings of the desires at stake that are both causal and morally important when we apply the language of genocide. And by that, I mean, in order to think about what produces an event of genocide, we have to have some underlying model of what the motors or the drives are behind, what the causal forces are. And analytical scholarship tends to focus on that. It also, and this is in the political discourse in general and in the scholarship, makes then moral or ethical claims on the basis of those causal desires. And I think that depending, you can parse it different ways and get a sort of a broader or a narrower scope in terms of what events you're likely to create or call genocide. I guess I'm interested in trying to think about what gets left out in each one of these circumstances. And so I'm open to the idea that purposeful negligence or willful ignorance or other terms along those lines need to be considered a little bit more carefully. It's interesting to me that in a lot of his writings, for instance, Lemkin, when he's coming up with the concept of genocide, doesn't talk a lot about the notion of intent very directly. That's something that's added on during the travel repertoire, and it's become important because that's part of how the law grounds and understands the stakes of moral agency. But again, if you're interested in assemblage thinking like I am, there's no such thing as an event of mass violence that is solely the artifact of one person's plan or design or one person's execution, right? These are really tremendously complicated emergent events. And so they require a lot more care than that. And in scholarship, that's sort of easier for us to unpack to some extent. We are good at seeing that. In law, I think that's harder. And so we end up in this problem where we're not sure politically what we're supposed to do when we move forward with a concept that's more complicated. There's not sort of an easy kind of model about that. Whereas scholarship, we've known that a long time. I mean, I think that Mark Levine's fantastic series, Genocide in the Age of the Nation State, begins essentially saying, single monocausal explanations of the rise of genocide from the actions of a few men are not adequate to understanding what's happening and the sort of isomorphic appearance of violence at different areas and parts of the globe. So for me, that's where I guess I land on that. I think that those are potentially important terms. I see them as, to some extent, sidestepping the complexity of the issue.
And related to that, you mentioned a newer concept of genocide earlier in our conversation. What does this newer concept look like? And is it taking into account some of the things that you've been talking about?
Well, I think that there's been a lot in the scholarly community of work in new directions. So again, I think contestable concepts, literature is a part of that. I think focusing and learning from complexity theory is a part of that. I think that trying to think a little bit along the lines of cybernetics and other new models is a part of that. Is it a complete break? I doubt it. Every period of discourse is going to have a hegemonic interpretation that develops, but it seems like there's been some shift to thinking about this in new ways. The arena of cultural genocide or socially oriented techniques of genocide have emerged or surfaced. I think that the late Claudia Card's efforts to think of genocide as a form of social death is really provocative and new. And I think that those are all kind of moments where you can start to see a break or a movement away from the hegemony, at least in the arena of scholarship. In politics more generally, there's a lot of different applications of genocide that are surfacing that are fascinating, right? So Amnesty International, for instance, in Brazil, has documents that discuss the possibility of a black genocide, which is a term that I think is hard to reconcile with the ways that the hegemonic understanding tends to deal or think about genocide. And there it's from police violence as a result of the state. Climate activists have been using, genocide in new ways to describe the effects of the Anthropocene and the fact that there are island nations that are disappearing that are, we sort of have explicit knowledge of and are not taking any action in order to preserve anything in terms of national identity. I examine in the book briefly the case of people who are opposed to the industrial slaughter of meat as another case where you see a kind of effort to apply genocide, not just, I think, to get attention, but actually because they're thinking more critically about what is the form or the type of violence that's at stake there. And what's interesting to me about that case is you can find everyday activists turning to that vocabulary, but also somebody like Jacques Derrida, who is a major figure in 20th century philosophy, used that term in that particular context in evocative ways. And so I see those less as sort of a coalescence around a new definition of genocide or a new understanding of genocide that is people that are using the language out of some degree of frustration and resistance to the hegemony of the hegemonic understanding of genocide.
I did want to return to the question of intervention and the changing in how some groups are using the term. In some ways, I think can connect to something you talked about in your book about the sort of institutional responses to genocide versus local preventive measures. And in this context, at least my perception is that you express some concern about the humanitarianization of armed conflict for genocide prevention. And if this is accurate, why do you have these concerns? And do these concerns connect in any ways to your thinking about the concept or the norm of the responsibility to protect? And then finally, and I can, bring this back up after the first question or two there. But how do these things interfere with local preventive measures?
Sure. So to answer the close to final, the penultimate question there, I think the responsibility to protect is part of a series of changes that are worth noting in the context of atrocity prevention or genocide prevention, in which armed conflict has become a tool of humanitarian efforts and been reframed in new ways. Although I don't think that the R2P is the case that I think is the most interesting or problematic along those lines. For me, that's more like the mass atrocity response operation reports that came out, I think, in 2010 or 2011. And some of the discussion of shifts in governance that that kind of documentation entails. And I guess my underlying concern here, and I think in the book I quote Sir Hartley Shawcross as saying war is the only way to solve genocide, or I can't remember the exact quote off the top of my head or something like that, but he mentions that in the midst of one of the dialogues in the ad hoc committee. I think that that's sort of what the international community has realized, is that we need sort of a full menu or a full spectrum series of tools, including armed conflict. And the prospect of armed conflict here alone is not necessarily what bothers me. It's not that I don't think that there should be potentially struggle in order to prevent genocide from occurring. It's the way in which that epistemology gets, the epistemology surrounding genocide prevention gets couched and used in the broader context of changes in armed conflict. And what I mean by that is that genocide prevention often in those documents is sort of looked at as a tragic or hopeless task. So we don't really have the tools to adequately and fully predict where genocide will emerge from. We know that it will happen. We know a lot of factors and conditions and variables that are part of it. And yet that very failure, the inability to make kind of a predictive diagnosis that's fully accurate, is the reason why we need more and more tools to go after it. And what I think is at stake there to some extent is the ability to manage life and populations at the level of their maturity and their level of their well-being. And I think you can see this in the responsibility to protect very clearly, right? There's a redefinition away from juridical sovereignty to concern for the welfare of populations and their responsibility being part of the state task. There's that one example of that redefinition. In documents like Morrow, though, it's much more transparent that that's what's at stake, that what we need to be contemplating is a way to execute an armed conflict or execute an intervention, if short of armed conflict, that would be successfully, you know, inhibiting the perpetrators of genocide from ever kind of getting to their victims. And in doing so, we may or may not need to sort of redefine the political circumstances and conditions that people have been in for a long time. And I'm not the first voice by any stretch that's kind of been skeptical of that claim. I mean, Mahmoud Mamdani is probably the best or most outspoken or identifiable voice who's been a little bit concerned about that process. The reason it scares me is that a lot of the critical security studies and critical military studies literature on armed conflict has noted that the past couple of decades with COIN, with the transformation of war, have really seen war itself reinvented as a tool or a process of governance, and that the boundaries in terms of what you do, who you identify as an enemy, how we are going to use violence as a means of governing populations are all really kind of in flux in that period. You know, classical warfare has kind of gone away, and we're not really sure what this new moment looks like, except that it has a tremendous amount of volatility. And if you read again some of the new atrocity prevention responses, they actually build that in. I think it's Morrow where there's three categories that they use, unlike traditional armed conflict, which would be, you know, just sort of offense defense. You have perpetrators of violence, you have victims of violence, you have bystanders, and then they use this category called other or others, which is just could be any of the other categories. We don't really know who or what they'll do, and as a consequence, we're not sure how to react. And that seems to me like a scary way to kind of militarize potentially any or all aspects of a humanitarian crisis. What's comforting to me a little bit here is that I think of this not as something that is largely in execution, right? We haven't actually seen that many militarized humanitarian interventions. It's in the blueprint and thinking phase, right? It's a discourse more than it is an actual substance. And so what I'm trying to do in the work is not to in any way call that like we need to step away from genocide prevention writ large or something absurd or like humanitarian intervention is bad. I'm just simply trying to get or think through again what the effects of those assumptions are in terms of the development of policies and programs out of them and tease out what's really at stake there in terms of power, in terms of ethics. Because as much as I think that some of the policymakers have, for good effect, turned toward and been more concerned with genocide, I also think there are some downsides to the way that then they operationalize the hegemonic understanding of genocide. Does that answer the question?
It does. It does. The hegemonic understanding in these types of scenarios also acts as an exclusionary divide between what are identified as R2P type cases, and then therefore also what are not included in R2P cases. So you mentioned the case of if there's the Black genocide, that's not really recognized as an R2P case, it's complicated, right? There's things like in a democracy, supposedly, you have these channels, to resolve these kinds of situations, and then therefore intervention might be seen as unnecessary. Or in Quadicard's theory of social death, or treatment of indigenous peoples. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think R2P cases end up being, or those that are identified as R2P cases, are based on these tyrannical regimes or dictators or authoritarian governments that are seen as treating their people a certain way, whereas the treatment of peoples by democracies oftentimes are excluded from these. I don't know if you have any thoughts on any of that.
Yeah, no, I'm in almost in complete agreement with you about that. I mean, I think that R2P is, I think it reifies status quo power relationships more than anything else, while shifting the grounds or the justification for intervention. In fact, I think that the material conditions in terms of who has power, who has military and sort of moral power, are both underline exactly how those interventions will occur. You know, it's kind of fascinating because we could talk about a number of cases like, you know, the Black genocide case or indigenous genocide. For me, what's interesting is how little patience sometimes the advocates for things like R2P have for hearing about the marginal cases that may or may not achieve recognition. Like I think that, for instance, some of Gareth Evans' work is really troubling in terms of it, how it deals with or understands what a responsibility to protect if it were embraced truly involves, and you know how expansive that would be. And if it's a piecemeal effort that's going to, you know, face all the obstacles that we know with respect to you know, intervention, armed intervention of any kind, then it seems like what its primary principal effect is just reinstating again those moral boundaries, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy in the international system. It doesn't then become the sort of international justice movement, which I think was behind both the human rights movement and the call to create a genocide convention initially, which is a much more expansive notion of the international sphere. I think it entails lots more redistribution of power. I think it creates many more limits for the state, which are probably antithetical to some of the tools that the R2P at least envisions as being part of the new humanitarian regime. So I have lots of issues with the way that doctrine has been iterated out, I would say.
Which, again, does not mean backing away from prevention of genocide, just, taking a critical lens to it.
The question you asked earlier that we didn't get to was the issue of local efforts, right? And one of the problems with coalescing or crystallizing around this new norm and in saying, you know, we need to sort of link every effort of genocide prevention is that depending on the whatever the locality is, there are efforts that are going around. I mean, genocide is never an event without resistances, both in the period of time when a mass violence is unfolding and in the aftermath to it. And so I think that the notion that we need to consolidate an international norm and use particular languages and get states to recognize how to abide by it, and if not, they need to have intervention, potentially precludes those in serious ways. And there's always probably a balancing act here in terms of what's the best option. But we also need to be cautious, I think, about deciding who's in the position to make those decisions. And I think that a lot of the scholars and the practitioners in humanitarian communities are. I think that the advocacy, again, in it, sort of the best faith reading of it, is that it's hard to get this on anybody's agenda. And so promoting it always is an important thing to do and is value. But at the same time, I think that there are some concrete things that can get undermined as a consequence of that. And I know I take an example here. So I'm situated in Tacoma, Washington, which is obviously, you know, part of the United States. It's a settler colonial state. And one of the big challenges here, for instance, involves federal recognition for the Duwamish, because that's where Seattle lies. And that's the question of who would be acknowledged or not acknowledged there. And I think that if the R2P were to be turned, for instance, in a case like that, it would be very awkward in terms of how to think about what the you know, different actors would be, what responsibility would look like, but it would also potentially not be welcomed by members of the Duwamish community who are people who recognize themselves as members of the Duwamish community, because it would also feel like, again, external intervention in a way that would not be productive for them. And so I can see a lot of issues surfacing.
It's important, in dealing or approaching questions around justice for indigenous peoples, not to have the colonizer dictate the terms of what justice looks like. And certainly you can comment on that if you want. But I also wanted to, as we begin to wrap up, have you gotten any feedback, responses to your book from other scholars in the field? Positive responses. I know that, I wrote a review that hopefully will be pending publication. Thank you before for the plug of my other research. And I did, of course, write a very positive review of your book. So, have you received any feedback and anything on the decolonization there?
I haven't gotten a lot so far. You know, it's only been out a couple of months, so maybe that's, you know, the end of the school year or something like that. There's one other review that I've received that was also positive, but it wasn't written by somebody with a genocide studies background. There's a blog called The Disorder of Things that focuses on kind of critical security and critical military studies that's run a symposium on it that's actually being in process today, I think, is when the third piece goes up, where there's some scholars that have responded to it. I'd say two or three of them are located in genocide studies or study mass violence in one form or another. And they've had some positive things to say, especially about the kind of showing how the concept has informed or produced inequities over time that are important, and probably taking that, you know, why is this case genocide in that case not, a discussion a bit further in terms of its evolution. In terms of the sort of anti-colonial ambition of the work, I haven't received a lot of direct comment yet. So it'll be interesting to see what people have to say.
And then the final question, or maybe the second to last question, who do you want to read this book? I mean, my review is written for a genocide journal, which, you know, is going to cater more towards genocide scholars. So who's the audience that you are seeking with the book?
That's a great question. I was thinking about this actually just the other day, because I had these other scholarly responses to it that I was reading, and I was curious as to what people would respond to and react to, and what they would like and wouldn't like, and, you know, those kinds of things. So when I composed it, and it emerged out of a dissertation project, and dissertations are always a mess. You know, I think about them like, they're like teddy bears, right? They're transitional objects. They've got bumps and bruises and all other kinds of stuff. And you get done, and then you take some time to try to make it into a piece. I tried to write it as accessibly as I could, given that some of the continental theory that's involved there is certainly probably likely accessible to a layperson, and is not every social scientist or a practitioner's cup of tea. But I wanted to make the point clear. My hope is that genocide scholars and practitioners would, prevention practitioners would read the book. I also think, though, that part of it's directed at some of the disciplines that surround that. So political science, international relations, history, anthropology, sociology, potentially. Because I think that it is a multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary intervention. And one of its primary stakes is just about how we conduct research and the assumptions that are involved in epistemology and the orientation that epistemology then has towards politics. And if there's really kind of a very simple point at the heart of it, it's that no one has really had the concept of genocide along or around long enough to really understand what its concrete political effects are. Right? It's nascent. It's new. And so some of the latching onto it and the orientation has, I think, a lot of unintended consequences that need to be kind of figured out and considered. And that's, I think, more than anything, one of the key takeaways. You know, who loses in the world of those unintended consequences? What do they develop and lead to? Is really a part of the key story of the book, as well as the fact that, you know, I'm not positive in the current moment, which has witnessed the rise of a lot of xenophobic and nationalist regimes globally, if a model of liberal humanitarianism is going to make it through and have the kind of teeth that a lot of its advocates envision. And there's even some scary things that have developed, right? So we've seen like the rise of hashtag white genocide as a concept in the United States in ways that I don't think we would have predicted 10 years ago would have been picked up in the same way, and kind of conservative or reactionary deployments of this concept as a means to crystallize or coalesce social movements. And I think that all of that really has to be taken into consideration and give us some pause. It reorient a little bit towards the concept as one that is about politicization first and foremost, and then has only as a secondary effect of that really led to institutional change. And a little more care and consider for the former, even if the latter is still something we pursue and develop. So that's a broad way. I mean, I hope that the book is accessible to advanced undergraduates. I hope that people in multiple disciplines read it, because I think it has important things to say about topics that all of them study in different ways.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, at the end of my review, I did say I thought genocide scholars should read it, because it made me think both introspectively and retrospectively about genocide, but also my contributions to the litter and my own research. And I think getting to students might be a good starting point also, before they're really doing some of the heavier work in terms of research, as well as advocacy for prevention and other means of stopping genocide and understanding genocide. So
Ben, we've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you so much for joining us. Before you go, could you tell our audience one last thing, a little bit about what you are currently working on?
Sure. I have two different big projects that I'm working on. The first is actually perhaps a little bit silly to a casual observer. I'm actually working on non-human animals and their role in humanitarian intervention practices. So demining dogs, bovines that produce milk that are used in emergency circumstances, things along that lines. Part of my commitment to assemblage thinking is to try to understand all of the different agencies that are involved in making these practices possible. And we have lots of great studies on what humanitarian practitioners can do, but less so on their companions. And that's a shorter project, but it's one that's really intrigued me because I think that actually non-human animals show up in fascinating ways in humanitarianism, which is, of course, defined by human compassion and human interest. So that was a just fascinating kind of side study that I developed. The larger ambition is to look at, and the sort of second project is to look at some of the assemblage models and to diagnose or examine cases of mass violence more directly, and to look at weapons and apparatuses that are used there. So here we're thinking about things like concentration camps, potentially death marches, the use of different kinds of weaponry. That's become a model that's been used in critical military studies, critical war studies, really effectively to try to tease out what shifts and what kind of paradigms are at stake there and what politically we can do about it. And I don't think anyone's really taken that model exactly with in the context of genocide studies or mass violence. So that's what I'm hoping to kind of transition from. And for me, that's also getting away a little bit from concepts and ideas and discourses and into things much more directly. So that's kind of where I hope to go. But let me say thank you for having me and for spotlighting this work. It's been a pleasure talking about it, and I'm happy to do so at any time, but it was also a real honor.
Great. Thanks, Ben. It was an honor having you on the show. These sound like great projects. Thank you for being with us today. I really enjoyed it. And take care, Ben.
Thanks.